Grade 6 Conference, Lecture 60, Mohammed. This takes us 100-120 years further than the life of Clovis. So now we're in the year 569, and we're looking at a part of the world that we haven't really looked at since fifth grade. The Fertile Crescent, but taking it a little bit further inland, Arabia. And here we find a people who still hold on very strongly to the vestiges of what might be called animistic culture. We don't really have a true priestly class. We have tribal societies and the worship of all kinds of things in the natural world, including, very importantly, a black stone called the Kaaba, which is said to have fallen to the earth, being a gift of an angel to Abraham. So these are Semitic people, and these are people who have a connection with Abraham. Some would say it's Jacob leading the Israelites and his brother Esau, who then brings the people of Arabia, others connected to the sons of Noah. But you have a Semitic people who, however, were not brought under the sway of the monotheistic culture of the Israelites, later also that of the Christians. Muhammad actually comes from a family whose task it is to guard the Kaaba. So he's brought very strongly into this culture of belief in, we could say, the supernatural, if not completely a full picture of the divine. And then as a young man, he gets involved in the world of trade and commerce, becomes a merchant even in his teenage years, goes along with the caravans, sees more of the world, actually is connected with the bazaar in Damascus, the same city in which St. Paul had his powerful vision of the disincarnate Christ, and comes into connection with Jewish merchants and Christian merchants who tell him about monotheism, that there's one God and this is what they worship. And this plants a sort of seed in Muhammad. Now, I have had the good fortune of being in Turkey and spending some time in the bazaars there, which in certain ways haven't changed in many respects from what they were like at the time of Muhammad. And when you meet the merchants there, you can understand why philosophy and religion and a kind of wider worldview certainly spread via commerce and merchants. These are men, mostly men, in fact, all men, I think, in the bazaars, who come to know the peoples of the world just by selling to them or by trading with them in one way or another. So Muhammad has an unusual cosmopolitanism, an unusual exposure to other worldviews for compared to most of those with whom he was raised. And his skills as a merchant led him to be drawn into the confidence of a wealthy widow, and she not only liked his way of trading her goods and helping her financially, but also fell in love with him. They marry, and now Muhammad becomes a very prosperous individual who does not have to work nearly so hard because his wealth is being cared for by others. Now, this could just have led him to a life of ease and sloth, but instead, Muhammad still lived with the ideas that had been planted in his soul by the Christians and Jews he had met years before. So he would, at regular intervals, more and more frequently, go to a mountain outside of Mecca, where he lived, where he had been raised, and there he would involve himself in contemplative, meditative experience, not perhaps quite yet prayer in the true sense. And this is where and when he had the vision of Gabriel, whom Steiner identifies as a very powerful, very important archangel. Gabriel, who was also the archangel of the Annunciation, is very much connected with hereditary lines and with birth. He was the one who announced to Mary that she was bearing the Jesus child. So now Muhammad meets this being who takes him up to the heavens and there vouchsafes him a whole host of visions. And Muhammad lives with these, takes his time, and only when he is certain that Gabriel is truly divine and truly a good spirit and not a demonic one, does he then reveal to his wife, Muhammad's wife, what he has seen. Now it is said in one legend that at one point, when he is talking to her about his visions of Gabriel, he says, "He is here. He is in this room." And his wife looked around, doesn't see anything. And she said, "Are you sure?" And Muhammad says, "I am certain he is here." And at that moment, it is said, she began to disrobe. And Muhammad grew terribly embarrassed. He said, "What are you doing?" And she asked Muhammad, "Is Gabriel still in the room?" "No, he is not. He fled as soon as you began to disrobe." And she said to Muhammad, "Then I believe you. That was truly a good divine being. For if it were the devil, he would have stayed in the room and watched." And so she was converted, and then others near and dear to Muhammad were converted. Always a good sign when people who know the Prophet well and deeply, or know any great man, nonetheless still feel he's great and still feel his ideas are worth following. So that was showed the moral quality that Muhammad had. And now come the years of conflict, of difficulty in converting, winning over the worshipers of the old gods and nature spirits to a new religion in which the God transcends the mere things of the everyday. Now he introduces a concept much greater and grander. And this is very important because we see here a culture that in many ways is like that of the tribes, the Germanic tribes, who were converted just a few years before. And some of these conversions were still to go on for another 300, 400 years, even after Muhammad's time. Tribes, people who had their own gods and goddesses, but with a very sort of wild and often formless structure. Now they needed to be brought into a priestly culture. And the tribal peoples were not in the stream of evolution initially that came from ancient India, ancient Persia, that came from ancient Egypt, where there was already a priestly class. No, these were individuals, we could say, whose ancestors were among the last to leave Atlantis, and there were no more of the priestly caste left. So they had to fend for themselves religiously. So What Muhammad did was to introduce, we could say, a theocratic culture to these individuals. And he did not really have any kind of structure like that of the Catholic Church, which drew a lot from the Egyptian mysteries. Did not have bishops and high priests. It was instead really a matter of individuals going to the mosque, or if they couldn't go to a mosque, praying 5 times a day wherever they were. So the prayer rug, in a way, became the portable temple. So there was a great deal of mobility and portability. It really was something that could go well with Bedouin culture, with a culture of people who in many respects were still nomadic and who, because of the shifting desert sands, did not have that sense of solidity and identification with place. So there was something also there too in common with the wandering, migrating tribal people of the north and the west who found their way to Christianity. But Christianity brought a very solid structure, and as we saw with Clovis, there was a clear separation between the secular leaders, and this differentiation became more and more clear, who eventually were the monarchs, and the religious leaders, the popes, the bishops later, the cardinals, the priests. And in Mohammedism, this did not ever really happen. There was still, in a way, a strongly theocratic quality. Now, in our time, where many nations have moved beyond theocracy to monarchy and beyond monarchy, especially since the age of revolution, to more democratic or at least purely secular states, we can see that the Islamic faith, for this is a much trickier transition to make. And this is why it's good for the people, the children, to hear the life of Muhammad, because they can get a feeling that this is a religion born in a rather different way, and one that also expanded with spectacular, explosive speed before it could get codified, before it could really have a structure given to it. So there is, in many respects, still a quality of formlessness, a kind of freedom there. Surrender to God is really the main tenet of belief. Charity, the giving of alms, the honoring of Ramadan, and the pilgrimage to Mecca. But relatively speaking, it's a much lighter share of major responsibilities and very little in the way of ritual compared to Catholicism or to Judaism. And of course, to this day, we have the very powerful influence of the Quran, one of the major works of religious life. This, like most other great religious scriptures, was not written down. Muhammad did not write it. But from time to time, he would recite to his disciples the very words that Gabriel had spoken to him. And his disciples would write these words down on bits of pottery, on the bleached shoulder bones of sheep, even on sticks of wood. But these fragments got preserved very carefully, and after Muhammad's death, they were collected as the Quran. And so this is a very interesting way of assembling these very, very pithy sayings. And although Rudolf Steiner had many very critical things to say about Islam, Goethe actually was a tremendous admirer of the Quran, tried him to learn Arabic so that he could read it in the original language, and wrote poetry towards the end of his life, the East-West Divan, which was based on his experiences of the Quran and also of the influence of the great Islamic poet Hafiz, under whose sway Goethe came time and again. So a wonderful story about Muhammad is that at one time when he was fleeing from his many enemies, before he was able to consolidate Islam in the lands from which he came, he had to hide in a cave. And his pursuers were hot on his trail, very, very close. And while he was in the cave with a few of his closest disciples, a spider rapidly spun a web, which collected, of course, flies and other bugs from all over. The web covered the cave. And though a cave would have been a very obvious place for the pursuers to look, when they saw the thick spider web there, they knew that no one had been in that cave for a long, long time. And off they went past it. So tell the story of Muhammad, read from the Quran, and I would say to, you know, emphasize the fact that we are seeing here a religion that rapidly drew people from a kind of loose confederation to a theocratic state, but did not have within it the seeds of going beyond theocracy. So this is, of course, a question as the United States, NATO, the Western world decides we're going to bring democracy to lands with large Islamic populations. That's not always such an easy matter. You know, they haven't, in many respects, gone through a monarchy yet. This is why dictators arise so readily, who often connect themselves then with the Islamic faith. Not so easy to just jump into a secular, democratic, liberal democratic state as we have here. And it's good for the children to understand this, that there's something in Islam that brought together thousands, millions of people very, very rapidly with a common, very powerful faith, brought monotheism very, very powerfully. But on the other hand, did not have within it something to look towards the future of humanity leaving something that's purely religious and entering into another realm of life. And this is the kind of destiny that we face right now, how we can bring the powerful legacy of Muhammad into relationship with the modern world.